Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello everyone and welcome to the History of Byzantium, episode 280, The New Roman Empire with Anthony Caldellus, part 3, Narrative. The bulk of Professor Caldellus' new book is of course a narrative of the entire history of Byzantium. It's a comprehensive walkthrough of all the major political and cultural developments with footnotes leading you to all the latest scholarship on the subject. In parts 1 and 2, we talked about aspects of the book's introduction, which sets up who and what Byzantium was. Today, we get into the narrative. I picked out the topics I thought would be most interesting to you, the listeners, and so I asked him about Justinian, Heraclius, the Arab invasions, and then on to more recent, quote-unquote, events like the collapse of the Comnenian system of government and the Fourth Crusade. At the end of the interview, we put out a call for your questions. In our next episode, I will put your questions to Professor Caldellus. You can ask anything you like, and we'll do our best to get to as many of them as possible. Post them on social media, on the website, Patreon, or email me, thehistoryofbyzantium@gmail.com. Don't dawdle, though, as we will record again in a couple of weeks' time. For now, enjoy the interview. Professor Anthony Caldellus, hello again.
Hello, Robin. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, as always. So we have covered the structure of government and Christianity, quizzing you on your new history of the new Roman Empire. We haven't actually talked about New Rome itself, because your book begins with the founding of Constantinople. And I thought that was a good place to start with today's episode, where I want to kind of jump through the narrative, because obviously the bulk of your book is a narrative of the whole of the history of Byzantium, as we call it on this podcast. And so I just want to kind of pick and choose the bits I found most interesting, and I think the listeners will too. But let's start with Constantinople. So in your introduction, you talk about the founding of the city and what Constantine was aiming to achieve and so on. And I thought something I'd never fully taken in was that the Roman capital was a megalopolis, a huge city by design. So I kind of assumed, as I imagine many listeners did, that capital is a large city because capitals are large cities and Roman Empire is a large empire. But actually you make the case that this was by design, that this was engineered. Can you talk about why that was?
Yeah, so it's very important to, first of all, see this as a problem, because we're so attuned to seeing the Roman Empire as an empire of cities and for it to have a capital such as Rome that we take it for granted. But in fact, the Roman emperors in the 3rd century had shown that an emperor doesn't necessarily need to have a large city functioning as his capital, right, in order to be the emperor of the Roman world. They were itinerant, right? So they moved around the frontiers a lot. They were, what they needed were armies. Cities, capital cities, kind of optional, right? So making something like Constantinople or New Rome and making provisions for it to expand to the size that it did is a decision. And we have to explain that decision because it didn't have to be taken. And it's not clear that we actually have all the answers here. So we need more research on this, right? There are small scale factors such as, all emperors wanted to have cities named after them. And Constantine was someone who liked to name things after him. He needed to wipe out the memory of Licinius, who was his rival. And Licinius had made his mark on Byzantium. And so kind of refounding it as Constantinople was kind of the equivalent of what Constantine had done in Rome, where he had taken over the monuments of his rival there, right, Maxentius, and reappropriated them for himself. So he's doing the same thing in Byzantium. There's kind of wiping out Licinius and founding a city named after him. And all of that would have been standard Roman emperor stuff. But then he takes it to the next level. And I think the evidence is pretty conclusive that he intended this to be a new kind of Rome, an other Rome, a sister Rome. Eventually, the name kind of settles on New Rome, and that he made provisions for it to expand dramatically. So that's the decision that needs to be explained. And not only that decision, you know, the weird thing is that for 50 years after Constantine, emperors mostly did not reside there. Like they continued to be itinerant, and they didn't settle down there until really like around 380 when Theodosius moves there. And even he spent about half his time there, though that is significant in itself. But all the while, all those emperors who were not residing in Constantinople, right, Constantius II and Julian and Valens, they were still funding and expanding it. So like they seem to have been invested in this project of keeping this Constantinian megalopolis growing to the point where the court could settle down there eventually. And so this is what we need to explain. And in the book, I offer some ideas about why a city like this was necessary. And I mean, some of this is conjectural, but it has to do with the tendency of the Roman Empire to break at precisely that point. So if you look at Roman civil wars with increasing frequency during this third century, the empire tends to break there. And so one rival is controlling all of like the Balkans, two Byzantine, and the other is controlling Asia Minor. And there are a lot of battles that take place in and around the Bosporus or that point. And there are also proposals about, you know, rival emperors dividing the empire up at that point and so forth. So I think that there was a strategic function in sort of clamping the Balkans and Asia Minor together as sort of one unit so that this would not happen in the future. And by and large, it succeeded. That is exactly what Constantinople did for the next 1,000 years. So it provided this kind of strategic bridge. And it wasn't just strategic, it was also political. In other words, you get all of the elites from the main cities of, you know, and Greece and Asia Minor and North Syria invested in Constantinople. And so they're less likely as a group to break into rival factions.
Shall I just jump in?
That's a question.
Just jumping in to put flesh on the bones of what you're saying. Some listeners need the memory jogging. What we think of as the crisis of the third century saw at one point Palmyra out in the desert running what we would think of as Byzantium, the whole Eastern Empire, and like a Gallic Empire in Western Europe, and then a kind of Italy and Balkans Empire in the middle. So the fact that some elites way away from Rome could actually run the whole East on their own is kind of what's in the back of the mind of this idea.
And three times within living memory, there had been Roman civil wars fought exactly there. Once between Constantine and Licinius, I'm going backwards in time, and then twice between Licinius and Maximin Daya. And so that was like the ground zero for these kinds of wars. So Constantinople was affixed to that problem. And that's one factor. And the other is the kind of built-in structural imperative that emperors have to be surrounded by large groups that provide legitimacy. And, you know, that can be the army, though how much of an army can you have with you at any one time is a question. And whereas a city can have a much larger validating population, and which can then be invested with the role of the populus Romanus. And in fact, the people of Constantinople in the early laws, 4th and 5th century, are called Populus Romani, Populus Romanus, or the Romani, and so forth. In other words, there's this kind of cycle where emperors create a population that then validates and legitimates them through like acclamations and whatever. So there's a function of Roman emperorship that it tends to thrive when it has that kind of audience to project itself onto. And so emperors are always, you know, even the itinerant emperors are always creating little palaces with hippodromes next to them. You know, Galerius had done the same thing in Thessaloniki and so forth, because they want to have these crowds that chant for them, because remember, they don't have elections, right? They don't have legitimacy through heredity. So that's how they get it.
Which is a brilliant sort of alien idea to us, isn't it? That we think democracy comes from the people overthrowing rulers and demanding this is how we're going to be ruled. And you're saying, Constantine said, in order for me to rule, I need to bring a population to me to cheer me and say, aren't you doing a great job? You're the person we want.
Something like that, yes.
Yeah.
It's a real cycle of... it's neither a vicious cycle nor a virtuous one. It's a circular kind of argument of Roman legitimacy, like who is authorizing whom. And but that is how it works. That's how the Circus Maximus had functioned in old Rome. This is how emperors sound out the mood of their subjects, right? I mean, Constantine had even issued these laws that asked for acclamations in the provinces to be recorded and sent to him so that he could get a sense of what people were saying about his officials. So yeah, there is a concern for public opinion. And I think a big city is one thing that can create that, in, like right there, right outside the palace.
And one of the points you make in the book, going back to the Palmyra example, is I don't want someone who's rich and powerful living in Palmyra. I want them to live in Constantinople. They can still have riches in Palmyra, but I want them at the court asking me for their next favor, their next appointment. So exactly. if I don't have a capital, they will stay in Palmyra and then they can take provinces from me.
Yeah, you're centralizing the richest people, most influential people from the eastern provinces. And in fact, Constantinople was almost an investment scheme, because initially these new senators had to live in Constantinople. They were required to, right? And so it was a way of getting them to invest their money. They had to bring up a large part of it to Constantinople and promote its construction and expansion. You know, initially Constantine had built some manors for these Roman elites, including from Italy. So he transferred some people from Rome too, or invited them to do so. And it's a funny aside. So it's, you have a city that has houses and buildings before it has a population. But yeah, that's how it was made. And I did the math in the book about who these people were. So like, if you assume, so the senatorial class in Constantinople expands to about 2,500 people within a century. And, you know, these are aristocratic types, wealthy. Assume a minimal household of about 30 people. In Rome, for old Rome, we're assuming 100. So 30 is very conservative. These are like, you know, small compared to the Western aristocracies. It could have been much higher for all we know. And if you do the math, and you add families and attendants and servants and whatever, you end up with a large chunk of the original population of Constantinople, and 100,000 people might just be the domestics and, you know, clients and people supported by the senatorial aristocracy there.
Yeah, it's just so interesting, because I just had never understood that dynamic before. And the other thing you talked about that I thought was very interesting was, part of the reason the population needs to be big is that people are going to die off. That if you don't reach a certain level and keep new people coming in, the city will never sustain itself.
Yeah, so this is the death trap view of pre-modern cities, right? And actually, a lot of the data comes from London, like early modern London. And I don't know if early modern London is more or less sanitary than ancient Rome. I don't know. But the going theory is that large, sort of dense concentrations of urban populations in pre-modern times lose about 1 to 3% of their population per year through disease and, you know, fires and so forth. In Rome, you have malaria as a very prominent cause of death. And so in order to maintain a steady population, you have to import 1 to 3%, right? So that means to get from whatever ancient Byzantium might have been, at most 25,000, to Justinian's 500,000, that is an enormous increase. So you need mass immigration, not just to reach that level, but also to sustain it, right? So you're having a few thousand people need to move to Justinian's Constantinople just to keep the population at that level. Then the plague changes the demographic calculus altogether, right? But that means that there is this internal migration going on in the Roman Empire that in aggregate, by the way, is larger than the barbarian invasions, right? Barbarian invasion, the largest ones were something like 80,000 population, like the Vandals or whatever, with a army of maybe 15,000 men in that population. Occasionally, like Gothic groups and whatever. So the growth of Constantinople actually involved more people moving than that. Yeah.
It's just a really fascinating part of the introduction that I'd never, because I hadn't studied that period, I'd never thought about. The one thing the listeners will be familiar with is that people, particularly with hindsight, think, well, Constantine chose such a great defensible site. That's why, you know, what a great choice for a city. And then you look into it and you go, there's no river there. There are very few good supporting towns and harbors nearby and so on. And you find all these reasons why actually it's quite a hard site to build a mega city. And so you need a lot of work, obviously, these gigantic aqueducts just to keep a population going.
Yes, the water was a problem. And that's why we have all of those cisterns, right? Some of them very famous from movies and so forth. They're still there. They're not used for that purpose. But you needed to have large capability for storing water and bringing it from those forests out in Thrace, right? So Constantinople ended up with more miles of aqueduct than ancient Rome just for this purpose, right? So water is one thing. And grain is the other. So you have to feed these people. And that comes mostly from Egypt in this period, in the early period, right? And we're talking at its peak, we're talking about like fleets of ships arriving on an hourly basis because the grain had to be brought in during the sailing season, which was like late spring to early to fall. And if you do the math, it's a lot of ships coming in 2 times a year. I don't know if they could have managed 3 times. Just back and forth and back and forth. There was probably, you know, imagine a row of ships waiting to dock and unload and go back, right? Just like you would in a major harbor today. You look out and you see these big tankers and whatever, and they're sitting there and you wonder, why are they sitting there? What are they doing? Anyway. So these ships are constantly coming in, and they, of course, have Egyptian sailors. Egyptian sailors, you know, come out, they have shore leave, and sometimes it doesn't go very well. They get into brawls with the locals. They, you know, interfere in theological controversies when their bishop is at odds with the Bishop of Constantinople. So yeah, this is a massive scale logistics, kind of industrial supply for this city. I mean, it's not just something that was, you know, there. It was something that needed to be maintained at incredible cost.
It's a really interesting part of the book, and obviously, you then get into all sorts of narrative following on from that that listeners may be less familiar with because I haven't covered that. This podcast began in 476, so I would very much recommend reading that whole period because it was really fresh to me. But I want to jump ahead now in the narrative to the next question, which was Justinian. Who came fairly early on in the narrative I covered. And I just wanted to pick up on something. We talked about him in the Top 10 Emperors podcast where he did not feature, and which I was pleased with because my own conclusion was slightly negative on Justinian. But you made this very interesting comment because we, of all the emperors in Byzantium, we probably know him the best because of the amount, I mean, whether we can ever know someone, but, you know, the amount of sources we have and the laws that he approved if he didn't write them himself and so on. And you said at one point, I'm not sure I like the way his mind worked. And I'm not sure you could have said that about any other emperor because we just don't know. So what did you mean by that?
Well, Robin, I mean, to a certain degree, political leaders in all times are kind of in interconvertible in a way. Would you be happy having that guy as the head of your government?
I suppose it depends what state my society was in. You know, he definitely has his good points, but...
Let's start with those. Like, what do you think they are?
That he's very hardworking and dedicated and intelligent. And I forget if you said this, but both a good delegator and a relentless micromanager. So
yes.
So he's not incompetent. He's not disinterested.
That's right.
I think he is very egotistical, but at the same time, that means he's investing in lots of things in a good way. And if you agree with the gist of what he's doing, then you'll be pleased by the efforts he's making to push things in a certain direction. You know, he's optimistic, which, could be a good thing. Lots of other emperors would never have touched the Vandals, and you could say that's a great thing, or if depending on your perspective. So those I'd say are the positive.
Yes, points. I think you hit them pretty well. And let's add some of the specific policies that we might admire, which is that much of his legislation favors groups that had less power. So he intervened in marriage law and inheritance law and so forth to benefit women, daughters, right? Other sort of marginal groups, or, you know, it seems he didn't set too much store by one's birth, if judging by the choice of people he married, but also had in his sort of cabinet and in his legislation, right? And there are also a number of laws where you can sympathize with him because he's clearly trying to do what he thinks is best. And sometimes when you agree with him, you like to see him sort of fighting the good fight there. And he's clearly up against some shenanigans, and he's constantly having to close loopholes, and every law opens more loopholes, and he gets frustrated. He's clearly frustrated at what people are doing to get around his laws, and so he issues more laws, right? And that's how we end up with all these hundreds and hundreds of laws from him, right? He's trying to close all these loopholes that enabled corruption and exploitation. Okay, so There are things to like there. And I don't have a, personally, I don't know that, you know, taking North Africa and Italy was, I don't know, you know, worth it, or I don't even know how to assess that. But anyway, on the other hand, there are clearly things that just, so the intolerance is probably one of the worst. So when you have someone who's hardworking and very, very powerful and hates everyone who deviates from his idea of what a proper Christian Roman should be, that's a very dangerous combination. In fact, lethal, right? And you couple that with beliefs such as that homosexual activity causes earthquakes, which he's on the record as saying, and it gets, he makes life much more dangerous for a lot of people, right? And the biggest group he went after, of course, anti-Chalcedonians. It was so big, in fact, that he couldn't even begin to move against the ones in Egypt. There's just too many. And this shows you kind of the limits of Roman imperial power when it wants to do too much in too little time, right? You know, over time, it can do a lot of things, but just to persuade people to, you know, change their religious sort of affiliation that fast. He imposes the death penalty on apostates. You know, many people don't know this. They think that this is something characteristic of like medieval Islam or something where apostasy is punishable by death. But no, there's a law of Justinian about that. If you go Christian and you go back, it's death penalty. And he was also like his commitment to social engineering, no matter the cost to the people who had to bear, you know, the burden of it, is also very off-putting, you know. So the way his mind processes ideological commitments via bureaucratic procedures is sort of terrifying. And I don't like to see that part of it when it's on the page, right? Or in history, because we have accounts, you know, of what he did. So this is what I meant when I said I don't like the way his mind works sometimes. It's too inflexible, a commitment to ideological priorities that, you know, sometimes good and sometimes bad. But, you always have the sense that when they were good, he like marginally moved the needle to benefit those groups. But when they were bad, like it was really bad. I don't know. Did I cover what you don't like about him? Or?
Well, I was just thinking, it's interesting that a lot of scholars like, I forget who made the comparison originally, but comparisons to Stalin.
Yeah, Honoré.
Yeah. It's interesting because I remember someone saying, oh, it's like a McCarthyist witch hunt, his early administration. I was like, it's interesting you can be compared to communists and anti-communists in the same period. But I reflect now on, I'm very narrative based in my assessments, which I suppose makes sense because that's sort of the business of the podcast. My sense with him was he's such a true believer that he puts the needs of how he thinks the state should be ahead of the needs of how the state is. So he sends troops to Spain, which I don't see how he can think he'll have any hope of controlling or really keeping, while there's lots of Slavic groups moving into the Balkans. There are Bulgars raiding the Balkans, and I'm like, do you not see a danger there? And again, I can't divorce myself from the hindsight, of course, of knowing the Balkans is going to be a trouble spot. So maybe he had a sense that everything would be all right, and the Avars were not the threat they'd become. And I don't want to judge him too harshly, but
yeah, so there's our hindsight, and there's also his hindsight. And his hindsight was that North Africa and Italy, at least until 540, had paid off spectacularly with very little cost, and that you never know when an intervention in a distant place like Spain might seem far-fetched at first, but you just never know, because these barbarian regimes, right, the sort of barbarian kingdoms in the West, are, it turns out, much more fragile than they had appeared to be, which makes sense because they're just governed by a military aristocracy that's pretty thin on the top. And if you can split it, you have chances of grabbing a lot of, you know, territory and local influence. Or if you can just destroy them in a battle, you take over the whole thing. And so I think the intervention in Spain, which was precisely an intervention in a Gothic civil war, must have sparked the following kinds of thinking. Well, you know, the Vandals were kind of divided and it worked against them when we intervened there. So who knows? Maybe we can intervene in Spain and grab a good chunk of it, and maybe then the Goths will just fight each other and we can take the next. That didn't happen. So now you've got this chunk of territory in the south. Well, you're not just going to give it up because it didn't go like all the way. You just keep what you have. And that's what they did. So you can understand how he got himself into that situation. But you're entirely right that he was didn't calculate risk very well, especially in the Balkans in the east. In other words, those Western conquests, they required moving armies from the east to the west, and that left the east unprotected. It clearly did. It did in 540, and it right when the Persians burst in and sack everything, and it led to a long-term military deficit in the east because armies are limited. You can't just raise an infinite number of soldiers, especially when the plague is making it hard both for revenue and manpower, and also in the Balkans. So in a certain sense, there's a zero-sum game going on among all of the different frontiers. And so he creates one in North Africa, he creates one in Italy, he creates one in Spain, right? At precisely the time when the East and the Balkans are becoming riskier and riskier. So that whole calculation strategically, I think, was bad, and it had very long negative consequences. Now, there are historians who are defending Justinian on that, and you can definitely push a lot of the blame onto his successors, but I think the context of increased risk is something that he left to them.
Well, we could talk about Justinian all day, but
Yeah.
let's move on to the next headline-grabbing figure, Heraclius. So this was the one, as I warned you at the time, that most listeners were surprised didn't feature in the top 10 list, because most listeners think pulling the eastern provinces back from such a point of collapse is an amazing achievement. And again, I think this is a case where the narrative is so exciting, and the then loss to Islam seems like a kind of bolt of lightning that he can't be held accountable for, that they think, well, Heraclius is up there. Now, what's your assessment again, sort of, why is his achievement not at that level?
I don't disagree with what you just said. I mean, it's all true. The basic outlines of the narrative are well known. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about whether that merits a place in the top 10. And in that context, if that's the achievement, I would have at least expected, at a minimum, for him to have kept those provinces. Right? Now, granted, the Arab invasions were unforeseeable. They came from a direction where Roman strategic planning had not invested in defenses from that direction. Like, why would they? And your both empires, Roman and Persian, are exhausted, destroyed. We understand why what happened happened. But again, the question is whether you put someone in the top 10. Let me add also that he had contributed significantly to the bad state of the East when he took over by forcing this 3-year civil war that really mauled some of the few armies that the Romans had left by that point. So, okay, you might argue this is a sovereign question about, who rules, and in a civil war, everything is on the table. But, he was to a considerable degree responsible for that bad state, and B, he didn't manage to keep it afterwards. Again, you can excuse every one of those decisions. You can excuse the man, you can do all of that, but I still don't think that that merits being put in the top 10, especially because let's look at his accomplishment as such. It really consists of two campaigns, right? Now, I mean, they lasted for more than a year each, but there were two campaigns. And one was this Caucasian adventure, where we don't have a reliable, coherent narrative. There's some real debates about how you reconstruct the movements of the armies. But either way, no matter how you read it, it was brilliant in the sense of tactics and maneuvering, but it accomplished nothing, the first one. Like, Heraclius was chased around the Caucasus by two Persian armies most of the time, managed to defeat them, elude them, move very, very quickly, and get out without suffering losses, which is amazing, but it accomplished nothing. Didn't shift the borders, the strategic balance, or anything. And then there was a second one, which drove straight for the heart of the Persian regime, the agricultural base of the Iranian aristocracy. And that's the one that shattered Khusro's regime. But I'm pretty convinced that this was a joint Roman-Turkish operation. Now, Heraclius is writing back to Constantinople, and he wants to present this as a Roman operation, something that only he's doing. But even in those missives, he slips up sometimes, and you can tell that it's possible that the Turks were the larger army. And so this was, you know, he was happy to accompany them on this raiding expedition into Mesopotamia, which is now a feat of Roman diplomacy that they managed to organize that for both of these armies to be operating very far from their, you know, base. It's something that Constantinople had been working on since right after Justinian. So, you know, forging these ties with the Central Asian Turks that ultimately paid off. This was a global scale, right, geostrategic alliance where both Turks and Romans had an interest in attacking the Persian Empire at that moment. So I think it was a bigger achievement of diplomacy that had been put together by Heraclius' predecessors, in particular Justin II, than a military achievement that he accomplished. So that's my response to the pro Heraclius crowd. And if they want to write back or push back against any of these points, I'm happy to continue the conversation.
I mean, I think that it's why I was so pleased with your top 10s, because your approach is different to a lot of listeners, which I think, again, is very narrative based. So Isaac II Angelos, you ranked as one of the worst emperors. And I think narratively, there's a lot of sympathy for him. But you said, but this is what he achieved. So that's the result. And it's similar with Heraclius. Mm. Again, Heraclius gets a huge amount of sympathy. And so that sort of excuses failings in people's assessment.
Well, let me add that Heraclius has been heroized in Western tradition, especially in connection with the Crusades. At the time, in medieval Western Europe, as a kind of proto-crusader, and both because of his own propaganda, which at the time, right, had elements such as like duels and, you know, heroic warfare and speeches to his army about the sovereignty of the Roman people and the independence of Rome and things like that, that invested him with this kind of like aura of, you know, a sort of noble crusader in distant lands and whatever, whatever. It's a long tradition that is still kind of shaping how he's remembered. Where his wars against the Persians kind of blur into crusading anti-Muslim wars and all of that. I mean, we got to pick that all apart. That's not a real achievement.
Really interesting. And the part of the book that was most unfamiliar to me was when you covered life under Sassanid occupation in the eastern provinces, because obviously my research level, particularly at that time, was much less than it is now, but much less obviously than the level you work at. So I couldn't find anything about the occupation. The only comment people made was that, oh, Alderman officites in Syria and Egypt might not have been too bothered that they were being lifted out of the persecution of, you know, Chalcedonian Constantinopolitans, which, well, maybe we come back to that. So can you tell the listeners where you found information about life in the empire during that the Heraclian Wars and what the occupation seemed to be like?
So this was fascinating to me too, because I had never looked into this in detail. And when I did, and I found all that I found, for a while, I was thinking, wow, this requires a separate book. I was trying to entice a colleague who also works on like Middle Persian and, you know, get some Sasanian expert to do it together. So to be clear, we're not talking about the war here, like the military maneuvers. We're talking about what it was like to live for all of these millions of Romans in the eastern provinces, what it was like to live under the Persian occupation for however long they did. Some of them for up, you know, 25 years plus, some for just 10. And now, Robin, I got to ask you. So when you're reading history books, especially scholarship, do you often come across, because I do, the following kinds of statements about imperial expansion, often at the expense of the Eastern Roman Empire, but it's something like this. Such and such foreign, you know, invader, you know, conquers these lands, but the people on the ground barely notice that their masters have been changed, and they just go from one exploitative regime to another. And in fact, they might have actually even liked to not be ruled by Constantinople, because maybe the Persians slash Avars slash Turks slash whatever had maybe lighter taxes or whatever. Okay. I've seen this so much that it's now become like a trope that I'm sensitive to. And it's often coupled with the following idea. Most of these people are peasants and they don't care about the government is distant and just oppressive. All the government is to them is someone who comes along and takes taxes from them, often by beating them every once in a while. And so they're sometimes even happy to see those people get their comeuppance. Okay. Because these are apolitical types who often don't have any identities, because that's just all elite stuff in Constantinople. Like, there's this kind of narrative. And I think it is utterly and completely wrong. It's not even like misleading, which is the, you know, nice way of putting the theory you don't agree with. It's just out and out false on every level. But it depoliticizes the majority of the population and treats them as ignorant and indifferent, which it can't possibly have been the case. And that has happened in some recent scholarship with the Persian occupation. There's some scholarship which says, oh, this is no big deal. This is, quote, a bump in the road. Right. But all of the evidence suggests that that's not the case. Not only was the invasion itself, so the behavior of the conquering armies very, very harmful, destructive. So there's lots of killing and slaughter associated with it, but also mass deportations. So the one thing that, see, and the Persian shahs had always done this. Every time they invaded, they just carted off as many prisoners as they could, because there was like a manpower shortage, I think, always in the agricultural estates in Mesopotamia. So they would just cart away tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people. And they did this as soon as they got their hands on this population in the eastern provinces. They started transporting them down Mesopotamia to all of these estates and settling them on these, like, you know, agro communities to, you know, whatever. There's that. Then they strip all of the gold and silver that they can find. especially the silver is a Persian economy, preferred silver. So the churches just get stripped. You know, they hunt for treasures and money everywhere that they can. There is a lot of evidence that the occupation authorities were violent, but also, and here's the key problem, they were unaccountable. So in the Roman system, the Roman imperial system by this point has lots of options. It offers a lot of opportunities to subjects to contest what authorities are doing, either by appealing, by suing, or by complaining, or by petition. And you may or may not win, though the evidence is that the system was responsive. This is a key part of the book, that the imperial government at this time understands itself very self-consciously to be responsive to the needs of its subjects. And conversely, that its subjects know that it's trying to project and cultivate that sort of personality, and they take advantage of that. So the government is giving them tools with which to resist abusive officials, and that local populations, yes, peasants, are actually both aware of these and are using, right? We have lots of evidence to this effect. Now, maybe you win, maybe you don't, you know, maybe the system protects its own people, well, whatever. It's not different from any legal system in any country, even today in our democracies. You go try suing Exxon. This relationship did not exist with the Persian authorities. Appeal to whom? And so there are papyri from Egypt and also ostraca. Anyway, texts that are sort of, you know, temporary documentary texts that talk about abuses. People couldn't petition the local political authorities because they'd been sort of decapitated, and symbolically, I mean that, by the Persians. So they were like writing to local holy men and bishops and abbots and saying, my husband disappeared when the Persians arrived. What am I supposed to do with the whatever? Like, I can't, you know, there's enormous displacement. So populations who fled from the Persians, they moved west. They went to Constantinople. You know, ultimately, your Archbishop of Canterbury, Theodore of Tarsus, is among the people displaced. So this had ramifications extending to England, right? Maximus the Confessor, a native of the East, he fled. He had to go to North Africa to avoid the barbarians, he said. So the way I put it in the book is that, yeah, business as usual, I don't know. I mean, apart from the invasions and the slaughters and the deportation and the confiscation of goods and the disappearance of people and the mass flight and the fact that you're subject to a kind of arbitrary occupation authority that can take what it wants to fund a war effort against other Christians, yeah, apart from that, it was business as usual.
I mean, I really recommend people read that whole bit because it was so interesting. And it's kind of no wonder that down in Arabia, lots of people were saying the Roman world's over. Like, or, you know, the stable order, we're all, let's say, merchants heading into Syria or Palestine. Everything's disrupted. Everything's gone. All the people I used to deal with have disappeared. I'm having to deal with new people. It's chaos there. And yeah. And so on. Yes. And that was the next thing I found interesting, because the origins of Islam and the rise of the Arab caliphate, I did find a lot of sources, and obviously it's a bewildering and absolutely fascinating field. But the one thing that stood out to me was that lots of scholars seem to suggest a lack of centralization in the early attacks on Roman territory. Not necessarily they were proposing another narrative, just that they were questioning whether the attacks were centrally directed by an authority operating in whatever northern Saudi Arabia we would now think of it sort of area, and that questioning whether that was all retrofitted by Islamic histories when they were working out the you know the correct order of caliphs and who did what and so on. But you and your narrative felt no, these were centrally directed attacks leading up to the Battle of Yarmouk and so on, and the caliphs were in charge. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes. Now, depends on what we mean by the early Arab raid. So early, yeah, there were raids and there were minor things. And so the way it usually works is that there's raiding going on that's, yeah, decentralized, kind of random. You're testing for soft targets. You're finding where the weaknesses are. That doesn't have to be planned. In fact, sort of many empires before they expand, before we see the real armies move in, there is this phase of, yes, sending some raiders out. And in fact, this doesn't have to be centralized, because the problem you're facing when you're creating a new empire in, let's say, Asia, is that you suddenly attract too many people, get interested in what you're doing, and you don't necessarily have something for them to do. You can't reward them properly, is what I mean. And yet you don't want them to cause trouble. And so you say, hey, why don't you guys go see what's going on over there? And, you know, go test those cities in, like, you know, Palestine or whatever, and go, you know, and come back and tell us what you find. So off they go. And that's before you get your armies together. But when we get to the point in the 630s, when you're having battles between the Arab armies and the imperial armies, those are very clearly coordinated. And I'm relying here in part on Fred Donner's work on this, which is excellent reconstruction of the military logistics and numbers and so on. And his estimate, actually, based on the sources, the Arab sources, is that they maybe had something between 20 and 24,000 soldiers, which you might think was not much. And no, it's not. But you have to remember that the Eastern Roman Empire is operating with very diminished military capacity after that long war with Persia. And our calculations in our separate book on the field armies of the Eastern Roman Empire that Marion Cruz and I wrote, and we talked about it in a separate podcast episode and on my podcast, tallies very nicely with that. In other words, we estimate that that's pretty much also what Heraclius had in the East. And so, yeah, that's about 1.5 field armies. And by the way, independently, it's also about what the Avar Khan had. And, you know, we have some indications of the size of his army. It's about 20 plus thousand. So the numbers independently kind of check out that this is the order of magnitude that we're talking about. But here's the thing. The Arab armies are usually operating in smaller groups under the, you know, command of different generals. But whenever necessary, they pull together into one force. And the whole way in which they're moving and the coordination of the war in Palestine, Syria, and Mesopotamia, because they're concurrently taking on these two broken empires, indicates coordination at the center. Like, in other words, every time there's a crisis in one of the two fronts, the armies from the other move there and then back again. And so, yeah, you can't, that's not a bunch of independent warlords who are just kind of freelancing it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's also a matter of perspective, isn't it? Because I'm now researching the post-1204 period where an army of 2,000 can capture 20, 25 cities. And so the idea of an army of 24,000, it seems big to me at the moment.
Yeah, go back to Trajan and look at the numbers there.
Yeah,
that's frightening.
Absolutely. So, I mean, again, another really interesting part of the book. Obviously, an area where scholarship could one day explode with all sorts of new information, but
yeah,
we wait. So let's move forward in time. The next period, I'm skipping largely because I followed your work for a lot of it. So
yes.
This was less surprising to me what came out. But you made a comment, so jumping all the way to Basil II, just to remind listeners, this is obviously the caliphate has gone into permanent decline and the Romans have now retaken all these border cities that had been used to raid them. And so Basil II comes to the throne with the Romans as the kind of dominant power in the region again. And he has to deal with these big, long civil wars against his generals, Bardas Phocas and Bardas Scleros. And you made a really interesting parallel with earlier periods of Roman history. And I thought the listeners might be interested in that comparison.
Well, I think I compared it to the late Republic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a couple of things that suggested that to me. One was that the context is rather similar. In other words, these are Roman civil wars that are occurring right after a period of massive expansion of territory. Yeah, relative to the size of each state, right? We're not talking about all of Gaul, Caesar conquered, but all of northern Cilicia, northern Syria, the Caucasus, and all of Bulgaria, that's pretty large. So right after a bout of military expansion, Bulgaria is not yet at the time of the civil wars, but Basil was thinking about it. You suddenly have these large civil wars. So that was structurally similar because those civil wars create armies, large armies, and wealth that these rival generals can use to promote their political careers. And it's also when you start to have the Phocas family starts to build up its sort of its own client network within the armies, such that they can, just by virtue of the prestige of their name, command loyalty in the otherwise state armies, which reminds me of things like Pompey, who inherited armies from his father in a way, and Caesar passing the loyalty on to Antony or Octavian and so forth. So it reminded me a little bit of that kind of context. But at the same time, what was interesting is that you suddenly start to have these very large personalities that you know from a number of different sources. And I thought those were interesting too. I mean, from Basil II to the eunuch Chamberlain, Basil the Parakimomenos also, and the Phocas and Scleros and all of these people. You have Arabic sources and Georgian sources and Greek and Latin ones. And suddenly they kind of acquire this kind of larger than life presence in some of these sources, which I thought reminded me a little bit of the Sullas and the Caesars and Pompeys. Not on the same level. I'm not saying that. But it's rather reminiscent in terms of sort of structure and narrative.
Yeah. That's interesting. And there's a sense in which what's the Roman state going to be after this about those civil wars? And this may be overstating it, but I think it's Mark Witow's book sort of focuses on that idea that would a Phocas or a Scleros have gone on expanding or attacking, or the idea that Nikephoros Phocas would sort of make Roman armies more crusader or jihad minded in terms of what that sort of thought is going around of what might the state be, or is the state going to stay in Constantinople and Orthodoxy and those things?
Oh, sure. I don't think there was ever a real possibility that those things would change. So this is a difference from the Republican Roman civil wars, which is that back then the nature of the regime was in question. Right, because the senatorial aristocracy and that whole, what we call the republic, was falling apart. The wheels were coming off. It was clear at the time. Whereas I don't think that anything like that was in play in the 10th century. The nature of the regime was solid. I don't think any of the contestants here had any mind to change the fundamentals. It was mostly a question of who you put in who's in charge. So that is a major difference, which is why I would never argue that these wars have the same significance as those, because those were the inauguration of the imperial monarchy. Whereas I don't think that, you know, Phocas would have, you know, changed. In fact, I don't even think that there were great differences of policy about conquest. I think there was a kind of consensus about how much to conquer and at what point the conquest would become, you know, counterproductive. You reach a point of diminishing returns where you get more problems than assets. And I think they had all realized that they reached that point. Mm-hmm. What are you going to go into Mesopotamia and do what? Anyway, so I don't think there was that much at stake. However, because of the recent conquests, they had these large armies and it was brutal. Yeah, there's the same levels of brutality. If you look at the way that sometimes Basil II punished his enemies, it sort of reminds me of like Sulla or something like that.
There's kind of a structural similarity. Once you reach your goal, civil war follows because the armies are turning up ready to conquer more. There's nothing more to conquer, so they turn on each other in pursuit of the goals of their generals.
Right, because the generals, I mean, in both cases, so there's a structural similarity here, is that what do the generals do? Go back to civilian life? Like after you've been master of the whole East, and then you're like, okay, your term is up, now go home and I'll send someone else. And a lot of people are like, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. It's a really interesting comparison point. And it's one that I think no one else has made because of that divorce between Byzantine history and Roman history and so on.
Yes.
So let's jump forward to the modern era of the podcast, the Komnenian period. And this was actually several listeners asked me this question, but I'm passing it on to you, which was about the Byzantine Republic. Now, these questions came in before we did our recent episodes on government, where you kind of talked about the monarchical republic. And we talked about, we've talked a lot about how the government was responsive. And we've talked in the past about how emperors have to manage a coalition of support and to some extent get elected at times. So listeners were asking, does that concept change at all in the Komnenian period, where Alexius Komnenos changes the system of hierarchy at the court to be based on sort of who's related to him? Does that affect the government's sense of responsiveness to the people, given that you're sort of saying we are the elite and we can't be changed in theory because we are related to the emperor, and it's a status that can't be removed in the way an unpopular official can be simply moved aside? But that's the question that's coming up.
Right.
Not necessarily that's the argument, but yeah.
No, I don't think it changes, because the concept of the Byzantine Republic is not about the shape of the government. It's not about the shape of court titles, or even necessarily who gets them. It's about how the government or the people holding those positions understand their function, and to what degree they are in a dialectical relationship with the majority of the population, in terms of the point of the role of the government is to protect and promote the interests of the Romans, and nothing about that changes under Alexius. In fact, Alexius himself makes some of the most strong declarations of that principle. Now you can argue that he does so because he's being criticized, and he was being criticized a lot about this. To which I can say, yes, I mean, these are crisis years under Alexius. And so he had to do certain things that were ultimately successful, but unpopular in the moment. And this is the dynamic that plays out under the Komneni with regard to their popularity, not not Ioannis Komnenos, not John II. That guy was mostly just doing campaigns and was fairly successful and was personally, you know, kind of attractive, or, you know, from neutral to attractive. Those kinds of emperors are safe. They don't have much to fear from the body politic, as it were. You know, if you're keeping the borders safe, if you're not raising taxation too much, if you're not involved in scandals or, you know, ecclesiastical controversies or whatever, as he wasn't in any of those things, you're relatively safe. And one indication of that is that we don't have very many sources from his reign. In other words, it didn't spark controversies, and it's controversies that produce the texts. Alexis's reign produced a lot of controversy and a lot of texts because he had to do things that were very unpopular, like confiscating church plate or like all of that, which then forced him to take all of these measures, like, you know, pose as the champion of orthodoxy by cracking down on some poor philosopher somewhere, some poor heretic over there, right? These are like public relations gestures that he's constantly having to do. Those gestures are a sure sign that an emperor is trying to cultivate public support. And he's doing it a lot. All of the hair shirt wearing and the constant apologies, he's apologizing profusely for everything that he's done. That's not some kind of aloof, you know, hereditary, you know, family government that doesn't care what people think. Normally, like, Western monarchs who are hereditary don't have to do those kinds of things. They just say, hey, what are you talking about? I'm the son of the previous guy. Go away. And also, by the way, Alexius's inner circle was not all family-based. This is a bit of a misconception, but for most of his reign, it wasn't. It was an odd assortment of other families. There was a coalition of families that he had to put together, which was very tense. Sometimes he couldn't always trust these people. There were a bunch of foreigners. There's this Georgian guy, Pakurianos. There's a Frank guy who's literally called the son of Humbert. And so it's this odd thing. He reigned for so long that eventually the second generation of Komneni managed to mature during his reign, and he was young enough when he took power that he was then able to put them in positions. And that continues. But you can always tell that it's that there's this kind of probationary sense that they're being evaluated. Manuel II, we talked about, he plays the game so well that he was given some leeway, not too much, but he was given leeway in two areas that are significant. One is the expedition to Italy, which is he had vanity wars. Let me just put it like that. He had these vanity wars in Italy and Hungary and all of these things that cost money, very little return, if any. And nevertheless, they were sort of tolerated, though you can tell occasionally they're telling him, okay, all right, wrap it up. And also his sort of theological hobbies, those were also kind of he was given some leeway. And the reason for that is because of what I think is his popularity, something that he also cultivated a great deal. He was very, very successful at it. So we don't see in his case the government overreaching in some way that would indicate that it had kind of detached itself from that, you know, very close inspection that, quote, the body politic or the republic is always visiting on emperors. And then, you know, once he's removed from the picture and the whole Komnenian system comes under stress, like literally as soon as he dies, you immediately see the people coming out into the streets and occupying. Like, it's all there. It just, there was no reason for them to do anything. So the structure of court titles and who gets them and this shift to, which is true, by the way. So anyone who wants to raise this is correct, that the inner circle around the emperor and a lot of the top positions were going more to relatives than had been the case in the past. is definitely true and is something that troubled a lot of people at the time. You see this in Zonaras and Choniatis and others, and Ioannis Oxytis, Patriarch of Antioch, who complained to Alexis about this. In other words, the pushback against that was there. And as soon as the regime revealed itself as very, very weak or susceptible to the likes of Andronicus I, you know, they all just burst out again. In other words, they didn't reinvent kind of Republican politics in 1183. It was all there. It is just that the context has to be right. And I would remind our audience that when the Latins are about to take the city for the second time in 1204, Choniatis, who was no populist, admits that it was the people of Constantinople, led by Alexius V, who were taking up the fight against the foreigner after they'd sort of been abandoned essentially by the leadership of their elites. So it was all there. I don't think anything meaningfully changed.
So is it more of a cultural change that after a century of good emperors, all named Komnenos, all marrying sort of whatever you would say, 20, 30 top aristocratic families, that just has created a new currency in the culture, that if you are blood related to someone in that, the ruling clan, that is a leg up in power now. That doesn't change the fundamentals of how people see their state. It just is a new part of the culture that didn't exist in Justinian's day, when people could rise from nowhere and it didn't matter who you were related to if you were picked by the emperor to serve in a particular role.
Oh, people could still rise from nowhere under the Comneni. I don't think that goes away. There's probably less scope for it at the top echelons, I would say that. It's not something that goes away. We know of people, in fact, I think it was Timothy Miller who found that one of the top officials, the finance officials of Manuel, was raised in an orphanage. And yeah, they're people like that. They always are. But at the same time, yeah, you can see these top families monopolizing a lot of the positions. Yeah. In other words, yes, there is a kind of shift in the culture. You do start to have the emergence of a kind of aristocratic, a more aristocratic culture. Some of this has been exaggerated. So, for example, there's a reference, I think it's in Valsamon, a canon, well, titular patriarch, but mostly a legal scholar in the church, to someone who was punished for marrying into some segment of the aristocracy without imperial permission. And I think this has been exaggerated to mean that there were marriage restrictions, you know, in like the elite is cutting itself off from everyone else, even by marriage. But I don't think that's what that means. All marriages that had political or international diplomatic significance or possible impact, they all had to be approved by the court. Like it's just, and that wasn't anything new. That was in the past. And so I think that's what that means. I don't think it means some kind of restriction of marrying into the elite.
And does provincial separatism, as it's usually called, fit into this picture at all? Or is that an entirely contingent development around the, you know, sort of 1195-ish, bit before onwards, where rebels stop marching on the capital and they just start staying in their own province and saying, you know, something's broken here with our connection to the court, so we'll just stop interacting with the court?
So I've now come to believe that this didn't really exist.
Okay.
And, you know, we can discuss it case by case, but I mean, there are clear cases, like, for example, Bulgaria. But that's not what we mean. I mean, no. This is an occupied foreign state and people who had tried already twice before to regain independence and did so this time. You can count that as provincial separatism, but it's a very distinct kind of thing. And that's not what people mean. They mean things like Cyprus and like 1185 or something like that. But Alicia Simpson has recently argued, I think correctly, that Cyprus is not a breakaway province. It was a failed rebellion that stalled. In other words, what happens when you have a situation when you have a rebel who wants to take the throne, just like every other rebel, from within the family, kind of leveraging his Comnenian whatever, who fails to take the capital, but at the same time, the capital, who takes measures to suppress him, fails to do that. It just kind of results in a stalemate of them looking at each other, and they're both Vasilevsky Roman and, you know, minting coins. That's what that was. So in the past, those kinds of things resolve themselves by time. In this case, resolved by Richard Lionheart, which is an unusual kind of thing to show up in East Roman history. But there you have it. I've also looked into the case of Leons Gouros more closely. Mm-hmm. So this is this, you know, local, call him whatever you want, you know, wannabe warlord in southern Greece who takes over the Peloponnese and part of central Greece and is marching north when he's pushed back by the Marquis of, well, by that point, King of Thessalonica or whatever, you know.
Boniface of Montferrat.
Yes. There's no evidence that he began that movement before the Crusaders arrived, and every indication that he was doing it as a loyalist of Alexius III, whose daughter he marries during the whole business. And he did, in other words, Alexius III, after he fled Constantinople in 1203, is going around sort of maintaining his network of loyalists as the legitimate emperor. And Zgouros is just one of those. So there's no provincial split or anything like that. You can possibly make the case for this interesting character named Mangafas in Philadelphia in Asia Minor. And it's a tantalizing case. He keeps going back and forth between the Romans and the Turks, the Seljuks, right, in Asia Minor. And it's not clear, you know, what the attitude of the most of the people in Philadelphia are. They seem to be willing to be reabsorbed when that possibility exists. So with that sole reservation, that case of Philadelphia, which is right on the border between Roman and Turkish-controlled parts of Asia Minor, I would say that the provincial separatism has been exaggerated too much.
It's a really interesting thing, because we don't really, most of these things are just mentioned by Coniates. We don't know specifics. There seem to me to be, I don't know, three or four other figures who rebel either in Greece or Thrace or in Anatolia. And it makes me think, had the central court and army just become so weak that rebels were saying, well, I'm a rebel, and just hoping events would sort of go their way. An army will be sent to put them down, and they'll turn the army into their army. You know what I mean? I think there's a weak case there, that they're trying to separate like a province right in the middle of Roman territory. But are they just thinking, the court seems really weak, these armies are not even reaching me, so let's see what I can get from this?
So you're thinking of the sort of warlords appointed by Alexius III in the he's given various Balkan forts, like all these Ivans and people like that.
Yeah, there was a couple of, and then there's, you know, the guy who founds the state of Epirus, Michael.
But this is all
Dukas.
Okay. Hold on.
As in, when he's in Anatolia, he rebels and goes to the Turks. You know, just little. You know, and you wonder, what are they up to? Because they're clearly not going to take Constantinople with their tiny theme army.
Yes. So these are people who, and we, unfortunately, we don't have much information about what they thought they were doing, right? But they seem to be moving between, across the border, going to, getting some aid from the Sultan there, whatever, going on raids. It's unclear what their goals are, but these are individuals. there's no way to project what they're doing, you know, whatever you imagine that their goals are, onto provincial populations and say there's provincial separatism here.
Yeah.
The normal response to that kind of situation on the part of the provincial population is like, don't get in trouble. You don't have to fight back. Like, there's no sense that, you know, every little city or town or whatever has to like fight to the death in the name of the emperor. No, no, the emperor doesn't even want that. Mm. The emperor wants you to stay safe. Like, do what you have to, you get by, and then ideally the imperial armies will come back and restore things, as they did in that case. Alexis III shows up and he drives Michael Doukas away.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything is restored. So the problem comes down to what's up with these Komneno Doukai people.
Mm.
Like, what are they doing? But that's a separate problem. That is a problem of the disintegration of the Komnenian system. A, its expectations that it had built up, and B, its inability to deliver on those expectations in the context of the sort of late 12th century kind of collapse. But it doesn't have anything to do with provincial separatism. Like, no. I'm not aware of populations that just voted with their feet and like, we're out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, no. Some guy shows up with some Turks. You keep your head down and you wait for the Roman army to show up.
Yes, absolutely. That always makes me think, what a different world where someone comes back and starts attacking you in the expectation that you'll go, okay, you're our emperor now. Like, stop stealing all my stuff.
Yes.
But that's what seemed to be going on anyway in Anatolia. Let's go to the final question then. Sadly, which is the Fourth Crusade. You know, I followed Michael Angold's logic on this, which is that, you know, all the history, all reputable history spend ages talking about the great lengths that Enrico Dandolo goes to plan this Egyptian campaign, to get everyone in Venice to agree to it. So the idea that then he's on the way to Egypt and goes, oh yeah, let's divert to Constantinople, I'll just make that decision on the hoof, it seems completely implausible to me. It seems like Boniface comes to him with this idea when they're still in Venice and it's on the table, and he must have known this is a likely option. Otherwise, you know, how can he operate one way and then switch everything? So I was suitably harsh on the Latins for their hypocrisy and their behavior, but then I read your history and I thought, oh, I wasn't harsh enough. I felt you took them to task with even greater ferocity. I don't have a specific question to set you up, but do you want to just talk about the Fourth Crusade and how it was conceived to go to Constantinople?
Well, first of all, I'll address the topics, the question that you just raised, because I think this is important. The, let's say, conspiracy view of the Fourth Crusade, by the way, it was absolutely a conspiracy. 100%, even our own sources, the Western sources, describe it as such. By which I mean a collusion among part of the leadership of the Fourth Crusade to lead it there without explaining it to their own soldiers or to the Pope, what they were going to do, but to kind of manipulate the army in that direction. That's their own narrative about it. You don't have to... this isn't, you have to theorize to make it a conspiracy theory. It is a conspiracy in black and white. What makes it also a crime is that some of these people, especially the Venetians, had just sworn an oath to defend the interests of Romania and Alexius III in making a treaty with him, which was a very generous treaty for them. All of this business about the honor of the Crusaders and the hard decisions that they had to make, and the hand-wringing in modern scholarship about the tough choices that these noble Crusaders were facing, is all bullshit from beginning to end. However, one of the problems with the sort of conspiracy view of the Crusade is to blame it on the Venetians. And I think that's wrong. I don't think the Venetians were behind, and there's no evidence that the Venetians were behind the diversion. They were moved into that because I think they had no choice. And to answer your question specifically, Why would they prepare an invasion fleet for Egypt? And there's some evidence, by the way, just in terms of like nautical technology, that the fleet that they built for the crusade was specifically for an Egyptian campaign, not a Constantinopolitan one. And I'm fine. Like, I agree that that makes sense. Why would they change? Well, because the situation changed dramatically between the contract, and so the Venetians getting to work on the fleet, and the situation that they were facing when they had to set out, which was there were two key factors here. One, they didn't have enough soldiers to make an Egyptian expedition plausible. In other words, the organization had been botched because they made this contract that the Venetians invested a lot of money in building this fleet, but they didn't make the effort to ensure that all the potential crusaders in Western Europe would go through Venice. And a lot of them just went off on the crusade. Okay, we'll just head off on our own and get passage on a ship or whatever, and we'll meet with the army when it shows up there. But that means that they're not then there to pay, you know, their fee or toll or whatever to the main army. So, A, they don't muster a large enough army in Venice to make Egypt plausible. And also, in exactly that year, Egypt was taken over by Saladin's brother, a character we call Saphedin, who was a real badass and known to be that. So suddenly Egypt, which for, you know, around in 1200 looked like a target that, you know, was ripe for the plucking, suddenly became much, much more formidable a prospect. So those are the two reasons why the Venetians were willing to reconsider the target. But the conspiracy was actually hatched among a different set among the leadership, especially the Marquis we mentioned, Boniface, and one of our main historians, Geoffrey of Villardouin, the Marshal of Champagne, and others, who, by their own admission, were angling for Constantinople before it was known, before these problems were known. They were pushing for it, and even trying to like maneuver the Pope into it, who said no. And then when the original plan fell apart, they were already there pushing for Constantinople. So it was 100% a conspiracy. And in the way it was carried out, a crime.
Well, can I jump in there? Sorry. Yeah. So because Boniface, you know, without having to go through the whole history, he had family connections to Constantinople. He's ambitious and so on. So I can see his motivation. And I think the Venetians, they're the ones providing the intelligence, right, on the situation in Constantinople, saying we could take the city. So where are the French in this? What's their motivation? And what do they know about Constantinople?
The Venetians are not the only source. The problems that Constantinople was facing were well, well known. In fact, we have a report from before the Crusade that one of the key admirals, you know, probably one of the most important guys in naval warfare, you know, the turn of the century there, this guy called Margaritone, he actually was the guy who had basically confiscated the imperial fleet on Cyprus.
Yeah.
In a failed attempt by the Constantinople to retake it from the person we mentioned, Isakios Komnenos, the rebel whom they never managed to suppress. And he told the king of France that, by the way, Constantinople is like, you can really easily take it if you have a fleet. Like, it's not a difficult target anymore. So this was pretty well known that Constantinople was weak. It didn't need to be based on Venetian information. So the French were very well aware of this. And in fact, they seem to... Anyway, and let's back up. In the second half of the 12th century, there's increasing proliferation of voices in the West, in literature, in letters, in chronicles, whatever, that, hey, you know, at some point we need to take Constantinople. There's a prophecies about this, right? And a number of Western monarchs, or kings of France, sometimes even the German emperors, are beginning to toy with the idea of taking Constantinople and absorbing its titles into their own and sort of, acquiring the whole Roman imperial prestige that they thought that would bring, because it still had that kind of, cachet. And so this was an idea that was going around. It doesn't have to be focalized on specific people, though, as you said, the ones that we happen to know are connected to Constantinople. They do have family contacts there. So they also know what's going on. Alexius III is embattled. He himself is a usurper. From his brother, who was himself a usurper. They happened also to have a willing, pliable puppet in the form of Alexius IV, who was there, right? So we have to completely rewrite this narrative of Alexius somehow instigating this for his own purpose. He was completely powerless. As far as we know, he didn't even have any titles from Constantinople. So he was the puppet. He was the one being used by the crusade. It's completely implausible to believe this narrative that Villardouin pushes, but also a number of modern scholars, like, they really shouldn't be taken in by this, thinking, like, you read these accounts and they go something like follows. Ah, these crusaders, they really want to go to the Holy Land, but their honor compels them to defend the rights, quote, rights of Alexius IV. So they're going to go on this detour to put him back on his throne. By the way, he'd never been on the throne. He had no royal imperial titles at all, like, never had. And even the Pope called him out on this. You have no right to decide who is and who is not the emperor in Constantinople. He told him that you will not go there. You will go to the Holy Land or Egypt or close enough. So no, Alexius is not he's a non-entity here, and he proved himself to be a non-entity once they put him on the throne.
And do you think the French leaders talked themselves into this being a religious matter, or do you think they were just completely cynical? I mean, obviously that the two are not completely separate.
Oh, no, separate, I don't think those two are separate at all.
No.
That they were cynical when they... in the way that they informed the file and rank.
Yes.
The rank and file about their decision, yes, because they definitely knew that a lot of Western soldiers were prejudiced against the Greeks, and they made that into the central argument for, we have to punish the Greeks, quote, restore them to obedience to Rome. These are heretics and schismatics, and they've undermined crusading since the beginning, and we'll never succeed in the Holy Land unless we first take care of those Greeks, and so on and so forth. By the way, it's interesting that, to their credit, many of the soldiers didn't buy it and left, or grumbled or whatever. But for the majority, you're so far in at this point that, it's like, you've gone way beyond the point where you can pull out, and you're thinking, well, if they're saying it, and Constantinople has riches, and so maybe I'll recoup what I've invested so far and come home, which a lot of them did afterwards. So they were very cynical about how they manipulated their own army, and in a sense, that army is as much the victim of the conspiracy among the leadership, as anyone.
Yeah. Well, so pure speculation then. They restore Alexius Angelos. He says, I've looked down the back of the sofa. Turns out I do have all the money and I haven't bankrupted the state. Here's the money. Do you think they go, well, you have to bring 10,000 men to Egypt now? Oh, you can't do that, right? Well, we're going to take the city. Do you think they would have just found an excuse to take the city regardless of how much he fulfilled what he promised?
It's hard to know But I tend to suspect that yes, that their goal was to take over the city. But again, it's hard to know. So I'm not going to assert that categorically. I don't have proof that that was their intention.
No.
But their strategy doesn't make sense if you think that they're really planning on leaving. In other words, they keep extending this quote contract that they have with him to be his, like, you know, protection force or whatever. Yes. And they are the last in a long line of Western warlords that had dreamed of this, that had even tried to do it. You know, quite a few Normans had tried to do this. And you're thinking, okay, like, so what were the Normans? What, you know, what was Robert Guiscard or Bohemond or any of these other people? What were they planning on doing when they were marching on Constantinople with their puppet emperors? They all had their puppet emperors, right? So, you know, they knew that they needed to have a puppet Roman ruler because the Romans would never accept anything else. Because at this time, they're not planning on just like liquidating the whole state and putting their own in its place, which they did later. So you have a puppet emperor and you're his army, and you would then force him to distribute his lands to you as fiefs. I think that's the goal. So you keep a puppet in Constantinople, but all he has is a city, and the rest of the empire you divide up into fiefdoms, which is what a lot of them wanted. So I think that's the likeliest scenario, assuming that he could pay them.
It's very mafia-like. It's very like, we've got a gambler here. We'll just rack up his debts to the point where he'll forfeit, and we just take over his business and then take all the assets out of the business and then declare bankruptcy, and we've enriched ourselves and we move on.
They had operated that way many times. This isn't the first time they're doing it.
This is how you describe the Normans when they first appear in Italy.
But
kind of using legalistic pretexts to seize things and then extort the population and so on and so on, and until you are the lords of this place that you came in as mercenaries. And
that's exactly how it works. And any of our listeners who have gotten into a contract that it turned out long term wasn't as advantageous as they thought knows exactly how this works. And when it comes to the enforcement of contracts, there's usually a stick somewhere. You know, you can't just say, oh, I'm just going to pull out of this now.
So do you think, last question, that some modern scholars, whether they mean to or not, are taken in by the Christian rhetoric of it, that ultimately a crusade is a Christian mission for a good purpose, therefore this can't be just a cynical enterprise by our standards?
Well, I mean, there's Christian rhetoric on both sides, but you mean specifically Western medieval Christian?
That because the crusade is a spiritual idea, that the way they write about it, they can't fully divorce that idea that it's because it has a noble purpose on some level. I can't write about it in purely cynical terms, even just the leadership. I don't know.
Well, we certainly seem to be able to do it about many other wars, including wars in our own time. I mean, who believes that George Bush waged a feminist war in Afghanistan? But I remember that's how it was pitched to me.
Hmm.
Well, this gets us into the modern interpretations of the Crusades. And for a long time, you know, down to the 1980s, the cynical view was the dominant view. You know, if you read like Runciman on the Crusades, which is an excellent and very, very well written account, you know, Runciman is by no means an ideologist of any kind. And he has considerable admiration for a lot of the personal qualities of many of the Crusaders. And, you know, he spins a romantic tale and it's a great deal of fun. But deep down, he was very, very cynical about what they were doing. And that changed toward the end of the 20th century with a school of interpretation that was very pro-Crusade, in fact, apologetically pro-Crusade, and developed all kinds of other models which push the idea that the Crusades are this spiritual, religious, devotional decision that individuals made. It had nothing to do with profit or gain, or anything like that. Anyway, and now we're seeing the pushback against that school, which was dominant for a generation or more, that, you know, it added, you know, considerable insight and nuance into the whole movement and to how many people perceived it at the time and chose to engage in it. But it's certainly not the only story. And the more cynical players were always there, and especially in the Fourth Crusade. That one is one of the hardest ones to justify and to treat that way. Nevertheless, there has been, I mean, most of the recent scholarship on the Fourth Crusade is deeply apologetic in this way. It always sees things through the eyes of the Crusaders, is always trying to justify their decisions and see them in the best possible light. And, you know, you have a liberal use of the passive tense. It's kind of like, well, mistakes were made. It's like you're reading a Pentagon briefing about some botched campaign in, you know, Indochina or, you know, the Middle East. You know, no, yeah, it's exactly like that. In fact, the way Vietnam was talked about in the U.S. by establishment types was like, well, our noble intentions went wrong, or mistakes were made, or, you know, we didn't quite appreciate the response of the local population, which they also said about the Iraq War. Like, it's always the same kind of thing. So when scholars of the medieval Crusades are sounding exactly like Pentagon spokesmen, you got to start thinking, wait a minute.
Brilliant. Well, I very much encourage people to read the book, and for people who are interested to learn more, to follow the footnotes to learn more about all these periods. But if you have your own question for Professor Koldelis, his incredible generosity with his time means we'll do one more episode where we will put your questions to him.
AMA, so, ask me anything.
Yeah. My only advice would be if you think the answer could last an hour and a half, we may not ask it because we'd like to get to as many as possible. But ask anything you like, and we'll go through them and see what we can do. Email me, thehistoryofbyzantium@gmail.com, and we will see you in, we'll give you a few weeks to get them in, and then we'll go through them. So, yeah, Professor Koldelis, thank you so
Professor,
much.
You can call me Anthony.
I know. I'm very sycophantic when I'm on air, but anyway.
I see. Well, I was wondering, depending on which of our media lasts longer, the podcast or the print, in the distant future, I might be known as that guy who appeared on Robin Spears' podcast. That bloke who occasionally appeared there.
That's right. Yes, what a dream that would be. Anyway.
I'm hedging my bets here, you see.
Right, till next time.
All right, take care.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.